coming up, we got Derek Parker and Richie Saunders talking about the NBA draft, and also a big thank you, everybody. We hit our goal of 1,000 reviews on Spotify. Got another goal for you. Can we get to 500 on Apple? We're close. We're really close to 500 on Apple. So if you can, please give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. We'd love to get to 500 before the NBA draft next week. Coming up, Richie Saunders later in the show. But first, we got Derek Parker talking about some big NBA draft questions. All right, let's talk some NBA draft. Joining me from Sports Illustrated and his YouTube page, Derek Parker. Derek, what's up?
How's it going, man? I'm excited. 8 days away. It's coming up.
I know. We are right around the corner, baby. I'm fired up. Finals just ended. The Knicks won it all. We're going to talk about some lessons from these playoffs, from the finals a little bit later. But we'll start off with some questions, some relevant news in this morning. Why is Darren Peterson only working out for the Washington Wizards? Jeremy Wu and Sham Sharani over at ESPN reported that Peterson is planning on only working out for the Wizards, who have the number one pick. He's not working out for Utah like AJ DiBonsa did. He worked out for 1 and 2. Peterson is only working out for number one. I know you have Peterson number one on your board, Derek. I'm curious about what you think his intentions are here and what your overall thoughts are about the strategy.
You're right. I do have Darren Peterson number one on my board. I still think that he is, you know, the top player in terms of like looking at his stuff holistically, extremely good off the ball. I think that's really important in the modern NBA. I still think there's like some on-ball funk hanging around that like he's going to be better on the ball than it appeared at Kansas. This, though, is really intriguing to me just because there were so many questions about Darren Peterson that like adding even more questions to the docket is very interesting from his camp. Like, I don't quite know what the thought process is. I understand there's like the competitiveness of, we've seen top prospects before say like, I'm the number one pick, I'm only going to work out for the team at number one. But this is a little different, right? Like, there were a lot of question marks around his season at Kansas. So I don't quite know what the strategy is. If it's to go to Washington and try to be the number one guy, if it's to kind of posture to have the other two teams fight for him. I truly don't know. I think it's a very interesting decision from him and his camp.
I think it's about agency. Peterson and Keyonte George are both represented by the same agency. Keyonte George is an upcoming free agent 1 year from now, restricted free agency. I would be willing to bet that it has something to do with the fact they don't want both of their clients on the same team. They don't want De'Aaron Peterson stealing touches from Keyonte George and Keyonte George getting paid less a year from now. And De'Aaron Peterson, they want him in the best possible situation to have the ball in his hands. Unlike Dylan Harper last year going to San Antonio, we saw the whole story about, I mean, shockingly, Devin Vassell saying at the podium that Harper was unhappy about touches and role and all that over the course of the season. I can't believe Vassell actually said that. But the fact's a reality where if you go to Utah, you might be sharing the ball with Keyonte George and other ball handlers. They have Isaiah Collier, for that matter, with Jaren Jackson Jr. and Lowry Marketing getting touches. They might not view Utah as the best destination for him, whereas they like the Washington fit, and they know, worst case scenario, if the Jazz decide they don't want to take Peterson, they go with Boozer instead. Peterson would be the third pick to Memphis, which is a good destination, or the fourth pick to Chicago, or some team going over the top to trade into that 3 or 4 spot. So that's my gut feeling of what the strategy is here for Peterson. Nothing necessarily just about purely, I'm definitely going to be number one or anything like that.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. For Peterson specifically, I don't know that there's a bad fit. Like, he's going to have the ball in all of these places. Right now, for Keyonte George, maybe not the best fit. But in terms of the Jazz, like, he would be the building block, the number one guy, right? Like, he's going to have the ball with the Wizards, even if it's, you know, the Bulls, the Grizzlies, like, he's going to be your franchise piece.
Now, with Peterson being number one on your board, I already, at the risk of him becoming a megastar in what I'm about to say, getting clipped out of context, I'm going to say it anyway. I'm going to take the part of a Peterson skeptic in a front office, and I'm going to push back on you having him ranked number one. How can you have a guy ranked number one, Derek, who missed 11 out of 35 games? And one of those 11 out of the 35 games, he, 15 minutes before the game against undefeated Arizona, the biggest game of his life, found an excuse not to play. Oh, I'm sick. I'm not feeling well. I have the flu. How can you get that guy number one on your board when the alternatives are AJ DeBonta, who took his team into the tournament with BYU, and Cam Boozer, one of the most efficient, most effective college freshmen we've seen in recent history? How can you trust Peterson, this self-proclaimed loner, to be the face of your franchise when he doesn't show the toughness to play through sickness, who dealt with this cramping injury, and doesn't even portray himself as a leader? He says he's a loner, antisocial loner. How can that guy be number one?
It's a valid question. I think there's a lot of valid answers here too, though. It's super, super layered. I think firstly, like, the mental stuff with the cramps makes a lot of sense to me in terms of, like, it was almost like a PTSD aspect in terms of him, like, really not wanting to go through that again. Like, we know that he was hospitalized with the cramping. Like, if he would feel that popping up in the middle of a game or pregame, or had any notion that this was going to happen again, I think it makes a lot of sense as to why he was tentative to play. The other layer is everyone you talk to about Darren Peterson just says he is ultra competitive. He's a winner. He's like the consummate professional. Like, I think all of that lends itself too to, like, he's going to play in the NBA. He's going to be a very competitive player. And then lastly, I just think he's the most talented. When I watch him, I just get, like, my spider senses, my draft tingles. Like, he's just that good, like, on the ball, off the ball. Like, he's just a legitimate player. Again, the off the ball gravity, like, that is one of the number one things I feel like we've seen from this postseason in general of, like, yeah, you want your JBs on the ball. You want your guys, your number one scoring options, to have the ball in hand. But having a guy like this that can bend the defense without even having the ball, and then also having the ability to give him the rock, let him drive, let him pass, let him decision make, like, I just think it's so valuable, especially in a guy that is probably the best defender of the bunch, at least right now in that top three.
I think it's totally fair. And like you said, with the intel aspect with him, the intel is good overall in terms of his approach to the game. I don't think he's going to be a leader necessarily. I don't think he's a vocal guy. I take him for what he says when he says, I'm an antisocial loner. It's the truth. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You can still be a great player, but you're more in that Kawhi Leonard category, right? Where you're not necessarily a rah-rah guy. Like, I think Cam Boozer projects to be. AJ DeMonts is a very outgoing, big personality. I think he can mature into that. Peterson's probably not the vocal leader in a locker room, and that's perfectly okay. I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily, but I do think the cramping and all that is intriguing nonetheless. I mean, I think that's the main thing, and that's why if I'm the Utah Jazz at number two, I don't look at this as a one-to-one with the Ace Bailey decision last year. With Ace Bailey, the only question with him was he doesn't want to go there. But, like, the player Ace Bailey, you know the player Ace Bailey. You knew everything about him. There's no medical concerns or anything like that. You didn't need him to be in your building to feel confident taking Ace Bailey over Trey Johnson or the other guys available with the fifth pick last year. But with Darren Peterson, there are the personality things you'd want to get into if you're the Utah Jazz at number two, assuming AJ DeBonta is number one. And if he's available at two, you'd want to get into that. You'd want to get your hands on as many medical records as possible, give him as much testing as you possibly can, because everybody I talk to about Peterson around the league, everything you said is true. But everybody is also like, well, there must be something underlying the creatine thing. There has to be something underlying that creatine triggered it. I had Dr. Brian Suter on my podcast, who runs his sensational YouTube channel, talking about medical issues in sports. And with Peterson, we talked about how there's no way it was just the creatine. There must be something underneath that the creatine may or may not have kind of sparked to create cramping. And I think that's the one hole in the Ramona Shelburne story. Like, Peterson was very upfront, as you said, about the mental aspect. Once something traumatic like that happened, he didn't want it to happen again in front of tens of thousands of people in the arena, in front of millions of people watching. He didn't want it to happen again in the same way that it did before, which is why he always pulled himself every time he felt something that reminded him of that. That's part of it. But the real hole in that was that they said he started creatine at the start of college, and in that he never had issues before, but that's not true. He did. He did have cramping at Prolific Prep, at least one known instance. I've heard more than that at Prolific Prep. And so if there's something underlying that causes cramping when the muscles get going, I would feel really scared to draft him if I'm the number two team in the Utah Jazz when Cam Boozer's my alternative. I'd have a hard time doing it. So I wonder, Derek, if the Jazz could end up doing something crazy and wild and unexpected here and just take Boozer number two, as I currently have in my mock draft, as Bill Simmons has in his prediction on his podcast as well. And who knows? They've worked out Michael Brown, Darius Acuff. Who knows if they could get a haul to trade down for one of those guys if they're head over heels in love with those guys too. So what do you think? Could the Jazz surprise everybody here with all the Peterson doubt at number two?
I actually posted a predictive mock on YouTube myself today, and I had Boozer too as well. It's just another question mark with Peterson. It's like, you've already got this list. Like, even if he does end up being 100%, you know, again, he's a professional and he works hard and all these things, like, this just adds to the list in terms of like, well, why is he posturing and positioning himself to get to a very specific team? And why is that not our team? So I think when you look at all these question marks, and again, I have him number one, but if you look at all these question marks and you say, well, the alternative is just this winning machine, he's like an algorithmic, like the best 18-year-old player we've ever seen, it's like, it's not that tough of a decision, really. So yeah, I think the Jazz could certainly go that direction. And I've predicted them too, with Peterson falling to number three.
It's going to be really fascinating to see the way this plays out, though, because nobody really knows what the Wizards are going to do. They've been like very strategic in what they did. Like, Michael Winger went on Ryan Russillo's podcast the day after the lottery. Winger said to Jake Fisher on the record the night of the lottery, we're open to trading down. But there's no real like sense league-wide of who they favor at number one. It's likely AJ DiBonsa, which understandably so. He's 6'9", shot creator, projects to be better defensively long-term with his body and his measurables and his athleticism. Creator, improved as a playmaker. It makes sense why he would be number one. However, we don't know for certain. Who knows? It could be Cam Boozer, right? Like, they could take Boozer number one. It wouldn't shock me if they took Boozer. I think any of those three guys are a real possibility, and I wouldn't rule out necessarily a trade down either. If a team at two or three wants to move up to number one to assure that they get their guy, and if the Wizards still feel they can get their guy a little bit lower too.
It kind of feels like 2022 to me, when, you know, Jabari Smith Jr. was just penciled in at number one, and it was like, everyone, like, the snowball got rolling and everyone just went with it. And then draft night comes around and it's Paolo Banchero. And it's like, well, he was the guy the whole time. And that could very well be the case here. I mean, maybe Darren Peterson's their guy. Maybe they've had their eye on Cam Boozer for a long time. So you just never know. And I kind of like when they keep the cards close to the vest, give us some excitement here in the draft space.
Well, along those lines, you have AJ third on your board. What's the argument against AJ?
I think, as a person that watches a lot of Shea, based here in Oklahoma City, cover the Thunder, I just know how elite you have to be as a mid-range scorer to have that as your shot profile and have a really, really heavy dose of mid-range shots. I don't know that he is to that level. And obviously, that's a really hard level to get to. Shea is the two-time MVP. He has like absolutely mastered the mid-range. But I'm just a little bit wary of a guy whose shot diet is that mid-range heavy, despite having the tools to get to the rim. The three-point shot is so-so. Of course, it's going to get better. And then defensively, you talk about the tools. He's a fluid wing, 6'9", 7 foot. Why are there not more steals? Why are there not more blocks? I just have a few more on-court questions for AJ DiBonsa. And again, I think all three of these guys are star-level guys. I think they all have All-NBA upside. So me having him three is not like a detraction overall. But I do have a few more questions for DiBonsa that I think the other two have answered.
All right, next question here related to the NBA Finals and the playoffs we just watched. What draft lesson did you learn from the Knicks winning the title?
I think the biggest one was how important functional strength is. I mean, you watch, you know, Victor Wembanyama, he's unbelievable. We've been very, like, in the draft space, we've been very, very honed in on height and length and upside and positional size. I think strength is just so, so underrated right now. I think we saw it in the Mitchell Robinson, like, game-winning offensive rebound, right? Where he just, like, moved Wemby out of the way, plucks it out of the air, just, like, used all the strength in his arsenal to do that. I think you can see it in the way that Jalen Brunson is, like, not knocked off his spots. He's very stocky. I mean, Stephon Castle and Dylan Harper, how many times did we see them, especially in the Western Conference Finals, just go through defenders, like, put a shoulder down. You know, they completely powered through contact every time they got the opportunity. So I think strength, it's just a huge, huge thing right now. And we undersell it a little bit when looking at the draft. And I think the players this most carries over to is, you know, Cameron Boozer, how rootable he is in the post. Braden Burries is another obvious one, his combination of speed and strength. He's a blur in transition, but he's not afraid to put a shoulder in. Darius Acuff Jr., again, really stocky player. Cole Pete, one of the strongest players I think I've ever evaluated. So again, height and length, very important. I think it'll continue to be a thing, but strength, don't knock strength. It's certainly important at this stage in the NBA.
I think it's a really good one. I mean, like you said at the top with Cam Boozer, I couldn't help but think about Cam Boozer anytime I'm watching Karl Anthony Towns in both the West Finals, I'm sorry, the East Finals, and then the NBA Finals. Just the strength, his ability to attack closeouts and plow through people, especially those first two games of the series against San Antonio in the finals. He was just bigger, stronger, and he did a good job holding up against Wemby one-on-one too. Wemby, who clearly is, you know, pretty feeble, still needs to get a hell of a lot stronger in order to play and be effective at this highest level. And I think that ties to, I mean, I've interviewed a lot of prospects for my pod, and almost all of them are like the physicality, how tough it is. And I think that relates to exactly what you're saying with the strength. You got to be able to hold up. You got to have some functional strength, whether you weigh in at 185 or 225 or 260. Like, you got to be strong. And I think physically strong and also just mentally tough to be able to withstand that as well. And I'm curious, is there any guys that you kind of have concerns about when it comes to the functional strength aspect after watching these playoffs?
This is another player that I'm pretty high on that you and I have talked about, but Keaton Wagler is one that you point to just in terms of the frame. You know, he's just not a strong guy right now. I don't think he had, you know, the NBA level of strength training prior to this. Like, again, he was a complete mystery box coming in here, like really not known at all in terms of the draft space. And he's seen this meteoric rise, but Wagler just as a whole doesn't have that strength. He relies more on the craft in like a very Halliburton type way, like much more of a shooter shot maker. And he's gotten stronger, he's gotten bigger, he's gotten, you know, some more verticality to his game over the last season. But if there's anyone you look at in this top 10 that might not hold up with the pure NBA strength, it's probably him.
How about LeBaron Filon? I think sometimes you see him compared to these small guards that people mention. Oh, Jalen Brunson just won Finals MVP. He was amazing. But he's also like 215. I don't care, he's listed at 190. He weighs more than that. He's 210, 215, 220, something along those lines. LeBaron Filon weighed in 176 pounds, and he doesn't have those thick legs or upper body. He's not built like Jalen Brunson. Brunson's a truck when you stand next to him. Filon's very lean. I think he's always going to be very lean. And that's why with somebody like him, I mean, you look at the list of the guys under 180 pounds to get heavy playoff minutes, it's a very short list. And so with Filon, despite all his skill offensively, I got some concerns there, man. And I'm a big fan of Filon.
Totally agree. And the fact that he didn't add much weight either, like this is a guy that came back from his freshman season. Like this had to be the number one thing, was like put on that functional strength, like use that and put on weight. And I think he added 4 pounds from year one to year two. So not super ideal, like you said. And another guy who relies on craft, and that can be a good thing, having that kind of twitchy stuff in your back pocket. But certainly a player I would be a little worried about in terms of like postseason physicality.
I mean, this is why, like for some of the bigs, like Hannes Steinbach, I mean, when he weighed in at 248, 7'2 wingspan, you're like, oh, wow, good to see. Because I didn't know he'd be that heavier. Like even he's out of the draft. Luigi Suego is going to Villanova. He'll be in next year's draft. 289. I'm like, oh my God. Like you like to see that from some of these bigs. When it comes to projecting to the next level, or like a Merez Johnson type, 250, 6'9", 7'4", wingspan, that dude's functionally strong. And I'm going to trust his ability to defend multiple positions. I think for me, Derek, I mean, the strength, toughness, physicality aspect is one of them. The other one for me is just straight up the importance of the pull-up jumper. We see it in these playoffs, just the need just to be able to have a floater in the lane, the clutch shot Brunson hit down the stretch, the ability to pull up from mid-range or pull up from three-point range in the series between the Spurs and the Knicks on shots taken off the dribble outside of the restricted area in the fourth quarter. Brunson took 25 shots. He made 44% of them. The Spurs as a team took 42 shots, made only 31% of them. Wemby made 29% of his 14. Fox made 29% of his 14. Harper made half of his 6. Castle made only 1 of his 6. And non-Brunson Knicks made only 19% of their 21 shots. So just this was one of the differences in what was 5 really close games. Brunson hit shots down the stretch. De'Aaron Fox did not. Wemby could not create. Castle and Harper were very inconsistent. And so I think that's one of the things I'm thinking about. Like, who are the best pull-up shooters in these in-clock situations that have a lane to potentially grow into being a star at the next level?
I think the good news on that front is that this class has a lot of really talented off-the-dribble shooters. I mean, you look across even just the top tier, like Darren Peterson, AJ DiBonsa obviously can both get their shot off the dribble. Darius Acuff, one of the best in the world at that, at his age group. And then even in some of these like late first guards, like Bennett Sturts, really good in the pick and roll, can create off the dribble. Christian Anderson, one of my favorite prospects in this class, like most of his shot diet was off the dribble. One of the best shooters in this class. And then when you fold in the fact that he can play make as well, I think it makes him really dangerous. So this guard group can really, really shoot it. They can really shoot off the dribble as well. So yeah, I think that's great for just the postseason basketball in general.
All right, let's go through some of the prospects, starting with like guys on the top four. What they did in clutch time. This is according to Synergy Sports, clutch time within 5 points in the last 5 minutes of the game. Shots taken outside of the restricted area off the dribble. Boozer was 6 of 11. Peterson was 3 of 4. Wilson was 1 for 4. What do you think AJ DiBonsa was?
Oh man. Is it high volume?
It's 9 shots. Only 9. So we're talking low volume. How many of those 9 do you think he made?
I'll say
clutch
3.
Clutch time, he made 0. Zero. Isn't that crazy? 0 for 9. Last 5 minutes within 5 points clutch time. Some of the guards. Acuff, 7 for 17. Flemings, 9 for 16. Wagler, 4 for 18. Burries, 2 for 5. Filon, 6 for 15. Christian Anderson, 6 for 16. Okori, 6 for 17. Sturts, 8 for 33. Very high volume, the highest volume of all these guys. Only 8 makes. Tough diet for him at the college level. But any takeaways? I mean, we're talking with very small samples here, but just hearing those numbers, I'm curious, anything stand out to you?
I don't take a ton of stock, especially in the freshman numbers of like, I mean, you're a freshman. Like, that's the hardest shot in basketball to like will your team to a win, to like be the guy. So like, I wouldn't dock them like a ton, even AJ DiBonsa. Like, again, it's pretty low volume, but like, it kind of stands out to me that there's some dudes, like there were a lot of freshmen that like, they wanted the ball in their hand late. Like, their head coaches wanted them taking those shots. Like, I think that's kind of impressive, especially for the lower volume guys. Like Sturts, maybe a little tougher, probably should have had a few more makes in there as, you know, a super senior. But yeah, I mean, there's some guys in this class that you just want taking that shot. And I think at the NBA level, you plug them into a more role player type thing. I think that makes a lot of sense. So yeah, there's some really, really, really good off the dribble creators.
There are. And I think to your point earlier though about Peterson, you don't think he's elite from the mid range. 0 for 9. It's only 8-9 shots. The next 9 he might make 8 of them, right? So who knows there. But it's interesting to me as well. Boozer 6 for 11. Boozer, a lot of those are hook shots. So like when I say shots taken outside the restricted area off the dribble in the last 5 minutes in clutch time, that includes floaters, hook shots, pull-up twos, pull-up threes, self-created shots. And Boozer, a lot of those, I think like 8 of the 11 shots, if I remember correctly, were, you know, him kind of backing down a little bit, sometimes from the perimeter, turning his back and getting into a hook shot. That, to me, like, people view that sometimes as a negative with him. I'm like, I don't know, it's just another tool. He doesn't even have the typical pull-up two-pointer yet. He doesn't use that shot too often at all. But I think a guy that has gone from kind of an iffy shooter early in high school to an elite shooter late in high school and into college, I trust this guy to eventually have a two-dribble mid-range pull-up. That feels like an easy developmental path for him to go down. The fact he also has the ability to bruise and go back to the basket and go to a shot from a hook shot over the right shoulder or the left shoulder, this guy's got a lot of tools, man. A lot of ways that he can beat you, and he can play make out of it, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, people go to the like, oh, he's not going to be able to bully ball at the NBA level. Like, firstly, I'm not so sure about that. If you don't double him, like, he might be able to, with the strength advantage, he'll probably be able to bully some players at the NBA level. Mm-hmm. But also, like, everything you just talked about, great. Also, fold in the fact that he's going to make the right play if they do double him, and he's one of the best passers in this class, and he processes the game at an elite level. Like, we're looking at a better offensive player than is being billed right now with Cam Boozer. Like, he is a genuine, you know, three-level offensive talent, whether it's scoring the ball, passing the ball, rebounding, like, whatever. He's a talent, man.
We just got some breaking news. It's not the biggest news, but it is breaking news. I don't mean to tease you too hard here. Tiago Splitter is going to the Chicago Bulls. Sham Sharani reported the Bulls finalizing the hiring of former Blazers interim head coach Tiago Splitter, taking over for Billy Donovan. I think this is a good hire. I mean, he did a good job in Portland last year. Clearly, the Blazers are going to be cheaper here with their head coach hire. I think a lot of Blazers fans view that as a negative thing. However, you know, the other team that Tom Dundon owns just won the Stanley Cup Finals with their head coach who was once hired as a cheap coach around 8 years ago when Brind'Amour was hired by the Carolina Hurricanes, a legendary player in their franchise. I look forward to seeing what Portland does, considering the success of the Hurricanes. But for the Chicago Bulls, Splitter was damn good last year. I mean, he took over under adverse circumstances with Billups involved in the gambling scandal. And for Chicago, here we go. I mean, good opportunity with a good young team and the fourth pick in the draft.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Tiago earned at least a head coaching opportunity. So I'm excited for the Bulls in the sense that, again, the fourth pick, you know, you're likely getting Caleb Wilson. The 15th pick as well, where you're going to get another really good player. So he's going to have some stuff to work with. You know, Josh Giddey, watched a lot of him with Oklahoma City. Not maybe a player that you're going to have like long term, but certainly a player that can help those young guys get better. I think he did that with the Thunder. So there's some super interesting pieces in Chicago, certainly.
We'll be right back. All right, let's talk about second round sleepers in the 2026 NBA draft. Derek, you want to start us off?
I will. I can't wait to talk about Bruce Thornton out of Ohio State, Kevin. 6 foot guard. He has a 6'6 wingspan. I just think he is one of the most legitimate scorers of the basketball in the class. Never dipped below double digit scoring in his four seasons. He scored 2,100 career points. Per Synergy, Thornton ranks excellent, which is the best available for non-Synergy users, as the pick and roll handler, in transition, spotting up, coming off screen, in isolation, on miscellaneous plays, and even posting up as a guard. Like, this dude can score the basketball. He shot 75% at the rim, and he didn't dunk the ball one time, which I know people are going to say, okay, he's not a vertical athlete. 3 out of every 4 shots that he was throwing up were going in. Like, that's elite no matter how you slice it. And then I just like his combination of non-traditional athletic tools. Like, we talked earlier about strength. Super stocky, very strong. He's also got speed and balance and good footwork. He's got a low center of gravity. I think we saw some of those guys in the NBA Finals succeed. So Bruce Thornton, he's a player. I don't quite know what I'm missing with him.
I feel the same way as you. I mean, he would be on my list if you didn't snatch him, because I just think this dude's a good player. He's going to be a rotation guy at worst. His scoring ability is too good. He's, you know, even though he's smaller, he's so tough. 223 pounds. A long wingspan for a 6 foot guy. I feel like he's a really good bet to be a good quality rotation player at worst. And not only that, he's a solid playmaker as well. He's not necessarily like a savant passer by any means, but he's a connector. He can deliver the ball accurately. Give me Bruce Thornton, especially given everything that we saw with the importance of pull-up shooting. Bruce Thornton as a senior, 53% on pull-up twos, 34% on pull-up threes, 59% on floaters, has arguably the best floater in this year's draft class. He's just a bucket, man. He's got all the tools on the offensive end of the floor.
And you talk about some of those ancillary skills too. Like, he's turnover averse. Like you said, he's not just like the highest level passer, but he's not going to like turn you over to the point you're losing games. Incredible rebounder for his size. I mean, he's 6 foot. I think it was like over 5 per game, which is unbelievable. And then scrappy defender, workable as a shooter. Again, I'm like you. I just think he's a rotational level guard. I mean, we saw, you know, shorter players like Jalen Brunson obviously is in his like 1 of 1, 99th percentile for shorter players. But like Jose Alvarado is a shorter player that closed the biggest game of the entire NBA season. So like, I just think there's room in the NBA for Bruce Thornton out of Ohio State.
My first one, Virginia center, Ugonna Onyenso. I just love this guy. I mean, I think at 237 pounds, you wish he was around, you know, 10, 15 pounds heavier, but 7'5" wingspan. We saw what he did in the ACC tournament over 3 games. He had 21 blocks. 9 of those were against Cam Boozer. So Onyenso, to me, is just one of these guys where he isn't necessarily going to be a very switchable defender. He can be a little bit plodding. He needs to improve there. But as a rim protector, 2.9 blocks per game caused major issues for Cam Boozer. And then offensively, he's just a typical big who can set hard screens, roll hard to the rim. He made 69% of his shots as a senior. He's a solid decision maker as a passer, positive assist to turnover ratio. And I think the intriguing thing to me when I think about these second round sleepers is the perimeter flashes we saw from him. He entered college as a freshman at Kentucky, transferred to Kansas State, and then to Virginia. And he didn't have a shot at the beginning of college, but over his final 2 years, he made 74% of his free throws, and then he attempted 36 threes as a senior, and he made 10 of them. So it's not like a high volume, but it hints at that there's something there potentially with his shot to at least be a 34% guy on standstill three-pointers, and that's a valuable piece on top of everything else that he offers. So Onyenso is one of my first second-round sleepers here.
This is like the definition of a sleeper, because if he hits, like, I think he's going to be pretty incredible, and he'll be a guy that you can keep on the floor a long time. Per 40, just looked it up, 6.3 blocks per game. Again, like 50 of those were against Cam Boozer, who, like, we both think is really talented and great. I think the perimeter flashes could be real. Like, the free throw numbers are good. Again, a fine decision maker. Like, you're not really going to be putting the ball in his hands or anything, but like, he's not going to play you out of the game. Like, I think this is, again, the definition of a sleeper. And especially as the NIL is kind of thinned out the second round, like, why not bet on a guy who's going to be able to potentially protect the rim, do big stuff, and may even have a little bit more in his bag too.
Who's your next sleeper?
My next one is Alex Caravan. I know it's a guy you're very familiar with. Had him on the podcast. 6'8" forward out of UConn. I would just sum him up as a winner. Like, won two titles with the Huskies, played for another. I mean, you saw it in the past to Braylon Mullins. Like, that is just unbelievable levels of connectivity. He's big. He can shoot. Again, the connective passing, he just kind of helps offense to flow. He's got toughness. Maybe the defense needs to get a little better, but he does have some, like, fun shot-blocking stuff. So, yeah, Alex Caravan is just a guy that I think I'm going to bet on 9 times out of 10 in terms of the competitive traits, his compete level, the smarts. Like, you talk about high feel. I think Alex Caravan is one of the highest field players in the class, like, per capita. So, yeah, he's just a guy that I'm willing to bet on.
I think he's going to go in the second round, but I've had him in the first round on a few mocks. And every time I do it, people are like, what's with your love for Caravan? He's not going to go in the first round. I was like, I don't know. Maybe. All it takes is one team. I just think this guy is so much high skill and feel. He's a winner, like you said. He's just a winner through and through. The comparisons I have on screen for him, Ryan Anderson and Robbie Hummel, I don't love either of those. Do you have a better comp for Alex Caravan at the NBA level?
I don't think so. I will say, I feel like he just feels like a Celtic, and you're like, why do they have three of these guys that are all good, and he just, like, plugs in and is good immediately? Like, that's what he feels like to me.
Yeah, maybe if he does end up going first round, 27 to Boston, I could see that for sure, especially if they're going to trade a Sam Hauser elsewhere, and we'll see what happens with Boston this offseason. It'll be very interesting. I think with Caravan's defense as well, like, defense is not just being a lockdown on-ball guy. Defense is being in the right position, rotating, it's boxing out, it's competing on the boards, it's communicating rotations and knowing when to switch and when not to switch. Those are the things Caravan does at a really, really, really high level. And so I just think he does all those like high level role player things that lead to winning basketball. And it did lead to winning basketball at UConn. And so I feel really good about him as being a successful NBA player at the next level. My next sleeper here, Louisville guard Ryan Conwell. Conwell, I don't think he's necessarily a lock, but I think if he hits, he's going to be a really good player. And the main thing I really like about him is the fact that at 215 pounds, he's kind of a stocky, strong guard, very physical at-rim finisher. And, you know, he gets to the rim at will. He can, like, be a little bit more finesse, but he can also be really powerful on his drives to the rim. And then as a shot creator, He's got a diverse skill set. He made 41% of his catch and shoot threes this past season. Made 32% of his threes off the dribble, which isn't the highest amount, but given the degree of difficulty, not bad. And what's really interesting to me with him is the fact that he didn't really take mid-range much at the college level. This is in part, as we see with a lot of college athletes playing in an analytical style, they're taking rim and threes. But he did make 11 of his 18 mid-range jumpers. And so I wonder if there's something there perhaps with him as this end-of-clock scorer potentially, whether it's just as a spark plug off the bench or in the dream scenario he hits and becomes a starter level player who's, you know, on a path to be, you know, all-stars. I don't think he's going to be an all-star. I think he's more in the Norm Powell category, but Norm Powell made an all-star team, right? That's my point here. I think there's that path for him, and he rebounds too, and he's a solid passer. I like Conwell, man. I think he's a bit overlooked in this draft class.
Conwell is super interesting because, like, I'm sure just like me, you tuned into Louisville a lot to watch Michael Brown this year. And like every time, yes, I watched Louisville, he was popping. It's like Conwell can play. Like every single time you tune into a Louisville game, he's hitting shots. He's showing that toughness. Like, again, you talk about 215 pounds, like maybe a little undersized for a two guard, but 215, longer arms, gritty. Like I think he checks a lot of boxes in terms of an off guard. And I think the 3-point percentages stand to go up as well. Like the spaced out NBA helps guys like this exactly so much more in terms of both getting to the rim, but also just having the space to shoot the three ball. So I like Conwell a lot as well.
Yeah, he's, I think you're right. Like he's definitely undersized to be a two guard. So he needs to be more of a one in the NBA. But if I'm a team that doesn't need a guard in the first round, like I'm passing on Christian Anderson and LeBaron Filon and Bennett Sturts and all those guys. But if I also have a early mid second round pick, Conwell would be one of those guys that I'd be like, all right, well, we'll take a shot on a guard here and see possibly what happens with whatever he turns into at the NBA level. I think Jaden Bradley's another guy on that list as well. Emmanuel Sharp. There's Braden Smith. There's it's funny how deep this class is really with options at the guard spot, like at each level in the top 10, in the 10 to 30 range, and then 30 to 50. There's a lot of them. So it's going to be very interesting to see where these guys end up falling, who could slip, and also how it affects the trade market too, because there's so many of them.
There's only so many spots too. It's like, even at the top, there's all these different guards like Kingston Flemings, Braden Burries, Michael Brown Jr. There's only so many spots of guys who want like elite blue chip point guards. Then you get to that middle section where it's like, you talked about Filon, Christian Anderson, Bennett Sturts. There's only so many teams that, you know, maybe even need a guy that's not necessarily a projected starter, but six man type guy. And then you go a step further and it's like, well, how many want to take a bet on the Braden Smiths of the world and Jacoby Gillespie, players like this? Like there are so many guards in this class. It's going to be unbelievable to see how it shakes out. Cause I think we're kind of looking at an era where like everybody has an established guard right now. Like there's not a lot of teams out there that need one and maybe need multiple. So super, super interesting. It's just chock full and I'm excited to see where they land.
Who's next on your list, Derek?
Next one, Tyler Nickel out of Vanderbilt. 6'7" wing. Anybody that takes 14 threes per 100 possessions just like goes on my list. I'm like, I'll come back to you. I'll see if you can do anything else. And the answer to that question for Tyler Nickel is maybe. I dug more into his game. He has an insanely weird shot profile. He took 36 shots at the rim in 36 games, 311 jumpers, 8.5 per game. So he was like, don't even care about getting to the rim. I'm just going to shoot the jumper. And that's like just weird enough for me to be into it. I'm like, fine, let's just play on the perimeter. Let's bend the defense that way. Like, let's just shoot the crap out of the ball. He's an elite shooting prospect any way you slice it, 40% on just insane volume, 52% on unguarded catch and shoot threes. Again, another player that I think the spaced out NBA is going to help a lot. More importantly, he can shoot legitimately off movement at 6'7", which is just like not often seen for a player his size. So again, I'm kind of just willing to bet on a shooter of this caliber, especially with the way that the NIL has kind of thinned out the second round. It's like, let's just see if this guy is something. He's obviously going to be able to hit his threes. Maybe he can develop a little bit more as like a team defender, like we talked about with Caravan, you know, add some of those ancillary skills. And then again, obviously he's going to have the floor stretching part nailed down.
He's a special shooter, man. I mean, the variety of plays Vanderbilt used him in off screens, pin downs and flares and just simple relocations where he's feeling the rotation and the defense and finding the open spots. I mean, there's definitely a path for him to have a long career as a three-point shooting specialist who can cut, like he'll have to screen and do some of this other role player stuff and become a solid defender, to your point. But I like him. I like him for sure. And I wouldn't surprise me one bit if we see him in a rotation getting big minutes on a rookie scale deal. Like just one of the true steals of the second round. I think similar thought process when it comes to shot making for our final one here of second round sleepers. I'm going to go with Richie Saunders from BYU. I know he tore his ACL to end the season at BYU, so he'll likely miss the start of his NBA career and come back early on in the season. But at 6'5", 6'9", wingspan, the dude is just an absolute bucket getter as a shooter. But he's not just a specialist. He's a good shot creator, quick decisions, the way he attacks closeouts and passes fluidly off the ball and hits these like crazy offhand layups at the rim. He does just the motor he plays with is just so contagious, like these just full sprints up the floor in transition, crashing the glass on offense. I can just see him being a guy who is playing heavy minutes in the playoffs. Just one of those guys that a coach can't take off the floor because he's got the shot, he's got the functional dribble, and he just takes so much pride and plays with so much heart on the defensive end of the floor that I don't care he's going to be 25 as a rookie. It doesn't matter to me. The dude has all the tools you want in a high-level role player in the NBA.
He's a madman, dude. I don't know if there's a game that he played for BYU where he wasn't like diving on the floor and doing all the gritty in the trenches stuff that you talk about. Man, he's like a total lunatic in the best way. Like, I think that's like what you want out of this type of player. You talk about elite shooter. He absolutely fits into that as well. I really like how little he needs the ball and how little he eats up on ball reps to like really make an impact offensively. Like shooting plays into that, but also, you know, attacking closeouts, he's just very quick with everything. He's very decisive. Talk about the connective passing. It's all in these kind of little in-between moments. So, yeah, I'm totally with you on Richie Saunders. I've seen some of the, you know, bigger mock draft people have him in the first, not necessarily in terms of mocks, but like on their board, it's like, let's just bet on this guy at, you know, 28, 31. Like, doesn't matter. Like you said, he's going to be old for a rookie, but just feels like a very pluggable player in a lot of different levels.
I interviewed him for my podcast, and that segment will be coming right up, talking to Richie Saunders. And it was funny. I asked him, what's the thing you're most looking forward to when you're back on the floor? He's like, oh, man, I just can't wait to put a swim move on a defender and crash the boards. And it's like, yes.
He's a lunatic.
That's the Richie, he really is. That's the Richie Saunders I love. That really is the Richie Saunders experience. Just he is nonstop, man. I just don't see how he fails. I really don't. I had him ranked in a similar range last year. I knew he wasn't leaving BYU after his junior season. I knew he was going to finish out, but I had to have him on my board a year ago. And it's just great to see him finally going to be entering the NBA. It's really crazy the way it ended, though. You know, four years at BYU, and then he tears his ACL, and now he's going to deal with that recovery, but it doesn't change my evaluation of him. It's just an ACL, you know what I mean? These are willy-nilly not a big deal nowadays.
Selfishly, again, based here in Oklahoma City, covering the Thunder, 37th pick. They're not shy of like the redshirt year. They like getting guys in the program and like letting them develop. Like Thunder, if you're listening, draft Richie Saunders. He'd be a fun cover for me.
Yeah, definitely would be. And he would fit that rotation very, very well. He'd make some of the more expensive guys potentially tradable as well, mm-hmm. I would think, at some point. I didn't plan to ask you this, but last question, Derek. OKC, how you feeling after watching the Spurs get beaten 5? Was there a piece of you who was like, were you happy about it?
No. I think the Spurs far and away like earned the Western Conference Finals. They were unbelievable. Victor Wembanyama is like one of the most impactful players I've ever seen. I was kind of just in awe the whole time. It wasn't as much like, oh, they shouldn't be here this fast. It was like, they're a legitimate basketball team.
You
like,
weren't hate watching? Not even a part.
I'm too much of a basketball purist to hate watch, man. It was so much fun.
I saw a video someone posted on X after, like, it was the morning after the Spurs lost, and it was this video of Chet Holmgren in a car rolling down his window, and he's dressed up in this outrageous outfit.
One of the top comments of that was like, we take Chet too seriously. And I agree. Like, we need to look at Chet a little less seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think he's that serious at all. He's a big goofy goober. That's for sure. But Chet, it is kind of something else, though, that Wemby second places, man. It just continues. A lot of second places for Wemby. U16, U19, Mets 92, the Olympics, and now the NBA. He's going to get one. The 1 year that he was on a team that won the championship, the 21-22 season, he didn't play. He got hurt during the postseason and didn't play in the final that year. So, hey, like, he's got to experience the taste of winning at some point. But that's the thing, man. Like, it's just Wemby's going to be back. Like, he'll be back in the finals. But you never know. You never know. And that's the scary part, where if I'm a Spurs fan, like, just continuing to think about it after this weekend, it's like, you were in it. You had a lead, a double-digit lead in all five games, and you lose 4-1. It truly is a missed opportunity. And that's that. I just would have a hard time getting over that if I'm a Spurs fan.
I'm worried that this, like, second-place chip on Victor Wembanyama's shoulder is creating a monster. Like, what's going to happen if he really does add to his game and, like, takes all of this very personally, and then in 2 to 3 years, it's just like, the greatest player we've ever seen, bar none. I'm a little worried that, like, he's going to come out of this, like, what's next after the monks? Like, who's he going to train with now? I'm scared of what he can become still.
I mean, we might see 40 and 20 a lot more frequently, right? That was kind of a taste of what could be that game one against Oklahoma City. And I think with him, it's just, to me, like, the big thing is you see the way his numbers decline in games, efficiency wise, as a shooter and as even a free throw shooter, the conditioning aspect. So in the series, in the finals, he shot 68% on two pointers in the first quarter, down to 22% in the second quarter, 63% in the third quarter, and the 36% in the fourth quarter. Three pointers, first through fourth quarters, 33, 22, 31, 25. Free throws, 86, 80, 86, 72. So there's the decline in the second and fourth quarters in all of the five NBA Finals games. And so he needs to figure out the conditioning aspect. I don't know if that's something that is in his control, or is just something, the nature of his crazy 7'7" frame, that this is going to be part of the experience, if they're always going to have to manage his minutes. But that's definitely, inevitably, it relates to what we talked about earlier, the functional strength aspect at the top of the show. The physicality, the toughness of the postseason, being able to withstand that when you're playing heavier minutes as a guy who played 29 minutes per game during the regular season. They were managing him the whole year. And then in the postseason, he needs to play high 30s into the 40s. Can he handle that? That's going to be the key, I think, above all else, is the conditioning aspect with Victor.
I think that plays into the experience too. Like, when you think of playoff experience, people think of, like, X's and O's and, like, the situations, like the final shot, but, like, managing your fatigue is, like, a big one that players talk about in terms of, like, postseason experience, knowing what it means to get to the finals and how to manage your body. I think he'll figure some of that out. I think some of it, like we talked about, just going to have to get more functionally strong, especially, you know, if he's still battling these bigger bodies like Karl-Anthony Towns. I think the unique position the Spurs are in now is, like, get him someone outside of Luke Kornet that can play alongside him, that can play in reserve of him, that is very functionally strong. I think the Thunder, to kind of tie this together, have done a great job of that with Chet Holmgren. Isaiah Hartenstein is that player. He can bang with, you know, the big interior players. He can also play in reserve and be that five. And I think the Spurs could really, really use a player like that. I don't know if it's going to be there at pick number 20. Maybe they can go up. Maybe they can find that on the trade market. But it'll be super important for Wemby's development and just skill level as a whole.
I think that's spot on, Derek. They got to find another big. And whether it's having somebody who plays next to Victor more often, or somebody that comes off the bench and plays only like a handful of minutes per game with him, I think having front court versatility is of the utmost importance in the NBA nowadays. And I know the Knicks just won the finals with typically Cat or Mitchell Robinson being on the floor, not both of them. But the fact is that if Mike Brown needed to, he could play both of those bigs. He could have Cat at the four as a spacer and Mitchell Robinson as the interior guy. OKC last year, with all their front court versatility with Chet and Hartenstein, or just one of them. And then Boston the year prior, with all the guys that they had, Porzingis didn't play a lot in the finals, but to get there, having Porzingis, having Al Horford, having depth at the in the front court is very, very important and helps dictate the way in which you can play and changes the way the other team plays. And if you can pull the small ball, you know, card out as well, OG and Anobi at the five, that's a great tool to have as well. And so I think having lineup versatility is so vital, and that's one of the things that felt like the Spurs perhaps didn't quite have in comparison to the New York Knicks with their lineup configurations they were able to throw out there.
I'll also say, not to segue this into a totally different thing, but he's just not a shot creator right now, Victor Wembanyama. Dylan Harper is unbelievable. I mean, this guy at 20 years old, I was watching him hit step back threes with 30 seconds left in the game in Oklahoma City, just like tearing fans apart on Oklahoma City's home floor. Like, that'll be a big part of this too, is like him being the shot creator, maybe being able to set up, you know, Victor Wembanyama a little better. Like, he's a legit player. And like we touched on the playing time stuff, like there's no way he doesn't start next year. And there's probably no way he doesn't take like a legitimate star leap. Like, he's that level of player.
Tell me this, Derek, for sometimes when like you see people saying, well, of course they have to have Fox because Harper's not much of a passer or a playmaker. He's more of a scorer. What do you say about that? Was this more role driven for Harper? Does he have more playmaking in him that he showed at Rutgers, in your opinion?
I think he strictly has more playmaking juice than he showed. I will also say, when you can score like this, the passing comes a lot easier. I think we've seen that with Shea. Shea is not just like an S-tier playmaker like a Nikola Jokic or a Luka Doncic, but the way that he can score the ball opens up passing opportunities a lot more. And in the same way that Dylan Harper is going to be able to do that, he's also going to have this 7'5", like Monk-fueled guy waiting in the paint. So like, I think the playmaking is a little bit overblown. I think he's just a really stellar player. He obviously has feel for the game, and he obviously has that kind of X factor in terms of what he did this postseason. So I think he's going to be totally fine on a lot of different fronts.
Yeah, I do too. I look forward to seeing what the Spurs do. It could be an absolutely crazy offseason starting in 8 days with the NBA draft. People can check out your stuff over at Sports Illustrated and your amazing YouTube page, Derek Parker. This is Derek Parker. Thank you so much for joining me today, man. Thanks, Derek.
I appreciate it.
All right, big thank you again to Derek for joining me. Coming up, we got Richie Saunders. All right, joining me now from the BYU Cougars, it is Richie Saunders. Richie, how are you?
I'm good, man. Happy to be here.
I'm excited to talk with you, man. You've been one of my favorite draft prospects, even going back to last year. I knew you weren't leaving BYU after your junior year, but I had you on my board. I was like, Richie Saunders, first round pick. He's a first rounder quality player. I just had to get it in there 1 year before you were going to be entering the NBA draft. But that said, even though you spent 4 years at BYU, there's plenty of listeners of this podcast that don't watch a lot of college basketball. So for those people, what's the Richie Saunders scouting report?
Yeah, I mean, they're gonna learn quickly, but I just put my whole heart and soul into this game. I love playing basketball, and I love doing the things that impact winning. I shoot the ball, but you know, I know how to get offensive rebounds, how to guard, and I'm honestly just really excited to get to this next level. One, be able to hoop again, but two, just be able to just grow and. I think I can bring a lot of experience, and just the details is where I live, and I love.
I mean, you're 6'5", 6'9" wingspan, measured very well with length and size at the NBA draft combine. And you mentioned your motor. I mean, dude, like, that's the thing about you, man. Like, obviously the shooting and all of that, but like the dives on the floor, the sprints up the floor in transition, crashing the glass, like you constantly are moving in the half court on offense. You're the type of guy that like a defense is always going to have to be concerned about, whether you're cutting or relocating beyond the arc, and never mind on defense, just the effort you put in off the ball. Is this effort level something that you've always had since you were a little kid playing basketball, or is this something you learned over time?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, as far as I can remember, I just I don't know. That's the only way I know how to do is just play hard. But I do remember in high school watching my first high school coach. He showed us a video of this. I wish I had his name. I just remember vividly this guy at Duke who he wasn't the most, he wasn't the tallest, he wasn't the quickest. But for 4 years at Duke, he figured out how to start and how to be on that floor. And I just remember vividly this one clip of him diving just for a random loose ball at half court and grabbing it and throwing it across and saving the ball. And I think something in there, as I've been thinking about this a little bit lately, like that came back to my mind of seeing that clip and just seeing how hard that dude played and how it got him, regardless of all the other noise and all the other stuff that was going on, got him on the floor, and how that was how he impacted winning and kind of inspired me. And that's just what I want people to take out of my game is it doesn't matter where you're from, whatever, where you're measuring at or whatever, and you can just go and put your whole heart into this game and have a great impact on the game because of that.
I mean, you were what, like a 3-star recruit, or what were you ranked out of high school?
I think I had a 4-star for like 2 weeks, but for some reason, I mean, as a 15-year-old or whatever, that was tough to hear. I was like, why did that go away? But yeah, I mean, literally, I think the highest I got was like 101 in the some of those rankings or whatever. But you know, that just grew the chip on my shoulder. And I mean, now I don't really care about that stuff at all. I'm trying to hoop and trying to, once you get on the floor, none of those numbers matter. But 100% coming out of high school, I was a 3-star.
I'm just trying to think of who that player could have been, because it's like Shane Battier came to mind for me. John Shire, the current Duke head coach. I know he was a hustler. Yeah. You're not sure? Is any either of those?
I don't even want to on a live air okay. thing, take a guess, but I literally can see the clip vividly of him.
Maybe Grayson Allen? Was he a white guy?
No,
Grayson Allen?
It wasn't Grayson Allen, but it was a white guy. But
okay. Yeah, it was John Shire. Who knows?
Completely just horizontal in the air, just sacrificing his body.
I mean, that is Richie Saunders. And I mean, obviously, like, you're not just a hustler. That's not why you're going to get drafted. You're also a shooter. Last 2 years at BYU, you made 81% of your free throws, 41% of your threes, up from 70% your first 2 years at BYU and 35% from three. What was the difference between your years as an underclassman and your years as an upperclassman? Like, why did that improvement happen? Was it something mechanical that you changed in your shot?
Mechanically, no. I think just experience is a real thing, and having to go from high school to being in a stadium packed full of people and having to handle all that pressure and stuff. Like, I just think I honestly got used to it. I just learned how to handle all that pressure better. But you know, I mean, I really appreciated the different, like, had two different college coaches and really appreciated the different things that they taught me. But I did appreciate how my KY helped to get me into my spots to where I've been effective my whole life. And just his way to help me get into those spots was something that, one of those reasons why I'm here.
Were you an elite shooter in high school?
I was, yeah. I shot over 48% from three in high school. Or my, like, senior
high volume
year
too?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I wonder, I mean, like, when I look at that, I mean, like, I'd imagine 2 years off, you know, from the court.
It's a real deal.
Your mission, right?
Yeah. It's a real deal. Yeah.
That must play a factor in terms of getting back into the rhythm. Going from high school to college, it's not like high school to college right away. It's high school 2 years away from the court full time playing competitive games and then to college.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, those were 2 years for my mental, strong word you want to use, but I'm mentally stronger because of those 2 years. And I think that played an incredibly huge role in why I'm here and why I believe I can make a great impact on at the next level. But it's different when your whole focus is not basketball, you know, and I chose to do that. I chose to step away for 2 years and, you know, learned incredibly all the life lessons and all the off-court stuff. But Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's different. You're not focused. You're not with a strength conditioning coach. You're not with your PD, your player development coach. Like, you're not. And so it did definitely take some time to get back into it.
From those 2 years, I know you did your mission in Seattle, Washington, right?
Yeah.
From those 2 years there in Seattle, what's an experience you had that made that type of impression and taught you a lesson in life that you'll always have with you?
Yeah, I mean, other than just like the general, like, met people that changed my life and all that kind of stuff. But I will say, you have to really choose to get out of bed. Especially, like, honestly, so I was called to Madagascar. I wanted to be in Madagascar. My heart wanted to be there. I didn't even bring a jacket because I was focused on prepping for Madagascar, not even being in Seattle. And so during COVID, that was the reason the change happened. But just every day making the choice to get out of bed. So you wake up at 6:30. I was up an hour earlier running hills in Seattle and dragging the guy I was with, sleeping in the car, and just parking the car at the top of the hill, and I would just be running. I would run and just really choosing to make that choice to put in the effort to get better. And then, I mean, just knowing that I was going to be soaking wet all day. The rain is no joke there. but honestly, like, I mean, those are some of those character building moments for me of having to choose to get up earlier, get my work in, knowing that I was going to be uncomfortable all day and I was going to have to get out of my comfort zone all day. And yeah, I mean, I look back with a lot of fondness for what that taught me, just the daily grind and loving the grind.
And like, I know BYU, I had read, was one of your dreams your whole life to go to BYU, and you go there, you spend 2 years there. Mark Pope, your head coach, leaves to go to Kentucky, and you actually entered the transfer portal. Decided to stay. Kevin Young gets hired straight from the Phoenix Suns. What was Kevin Young's pitch to you, and how did his NBA style unlock, you know, what happened those next 2 years?
Yeah, no, first off, like, I just have nothing but gratitude for Coach Pope, and he's an incredible coach, and grateful for what he taught me. But you know, like, his pitch to me was really twofold. I'm gonna help you become a better closeout player. I'm gonna help you become he's gonna help me become an elite closeout player. So anytime somebody's running at you, closeout possession. And then two, I'm gonna help you become elite at coming off of off-ball screens and reading the defense. And essentially, like, taking that and him explaining how he was going to do that, coming from his background, was really hard to pass up on. So I wanted to have a long career in the NBA, and he essentially helped create a great build and help create a great foundation to move into this next level.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned the closeouts. It's one of the things I really like about your game. In my scouting report of you, I wrote, decisive shot creator. Saunders attacks closeouts with confidence and finishes from the close mid-range area with incredible touch on floaters, runners, and offhand layups. And he operates with equal fluidity as a passer, making proper reads to find teammates within the flow of the offense. And so much of that for you comes within the flow of the offense, attacking a closeout, second side opportunities. And for you, that seems to be like you definitely took those lessons and ran with them on the court, yeah. Right?
I mean, you spent a lot of time working on those things, but yeah, I mean, so much gratitude for that staff. I mean, they were incredible, all NBA focused, and everything. They run that program like it's an NBA program.
You mentioned earlier how you don't know how to play any other way. You've always played hard. What was your first encounter with basketball, and who first introduced you to it?
Yeah. So my dad, he played basketball at UC Davis. And so him and one of my sisters, off and on, two of my sisters, but I had a sister that played a JUCO here in Utah, but you know, it was early mornings in the gym, combination of with my sister and just with my dad. But 4:45 in the gym was where I built my career. You know, that's we did that when I was 9. We started, and you know, honestly, like that's what I did for a decade. And I mean, that's just like what I get. I already said it, but just like when you work hard, consistently good stuff happens. And that's just like the principles that I've built my life on. And I mean, those were the early days of like, I remember one time when I was just crying on the court with my dad. And my dad, it was again 5 a.m. So my dad was probably like, what is this kid doing crying? But I couldn't make a shot. My dad was really good in those moments of teaching me of seeing the whole picture and seeing the whole thing as a career as a whole. And a lot of gratitude and just fondness of looking back at those early times.
With all this work you've put in, how crushing and what was the feeling when you did tear your ACL and that ended your college career at BYU?
Yeah, I mean, it was there's no words to express how hard that was initially. You know, it's I'm like, why did this happen? I've done all I needed to do to essentially avoid this. But yet, I mean, that's just life. I mean, there's a lot worse stuff going on in the world than a rehabbing an ACL. I'm going to be able to hoop in not that long. And so it's like I'm going to be good. But right in that moment of just like, man, is this it? Is this how it's going to end? And, you know, I think that like that was essentially like right my initial thoughts. But, you know, I'm married. So my wife, Sierra, we said like, how long are we going to be sad for ourselves? So we said 2 days. So 48 hours came and went. And then we were just like, let's go attack this thing. We're going to attack this thing and do what we've done before and just go do this thing. We're going to leave no stone unturned and just find every single additive to help with this rehab. And that's what we've done. You know, big lessons of controlling what you can control. And I'm ready to come out of this better than where I was before.
I mean, life gives you challenges sometimes, and you can often get better at from them if you approach it with the right mindset. And it seems like you and your wife, you have a rock in your life, approaching that together to get better from it. When you do get back on the court, what's the feeling that you're most looking forward to first time you get those minutes in the NBA?
Oh, man, let me please. All I want right now is to be able to just swim move somebody, get an offensive rebound. I would give anything to be able to just get on the floor and do that right now, you know? But I'm excited to hit shots and do all that, but I'm excited to get possessions for my team. And that's where my mind's at right now. But
how much did you love the OG and Anobi put back offensive board for the win?
I mean, you look like it's hard to box out every single time when people go every time. It's just the nature of it. So that's, like, I mean, if you're, again, I said it 45 times, but if you're consistent at it, like you get one. And for him, it just happened to be the biggest thing. But I don't know if I've seen a more important offensive rebound.
The crazy thing is for OG Anunoby is when he was in college, he tore his ACL on an offensive rebound opportunity.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Came from the left wing on the court, tacking into the paint. Wow. He tore his ACL on a very similar type of play. And then in the biggest moment of his career, isn't that incredible?
That is a cool thing. No, that's incredible.
Yeah, I didn't realize it until just yesterday. I saw a post about it. Like I've been covering the draft. I remember OG tearing his ACL. I loved him, but like I'd forgotten it was on an offensive rebound opportunity. It's kind of insane. Like just the way life is sometimes, you know. Wow.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is. What have been your takeaways from these finals and the NBA playoffs as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. This has been an incredible playoff just in general. But just, it's been cool to see the tougher team that just, there's not always the home run plays, but just the consistent, I'm going to say it 45 times, but just like people, like the Knicks have been so consistent with what they've done. I mean, they've shot the ball at an extremely high clip for most of the playoffs in general, but like, it's cool to see just them just be dogs. And it's going to be a good, this how this series finishes out and stuff is going to be, I don't know. Sorry, it's been a crazy series already, but
yeah. it's been nuts. It's been one of the best finals I can remember. I'm curious, Richie, like during this recovery, what are the things you're working at to improve? I mean, is there anything like from a skill standpoint you can get better at? Is it a film? Yeah. Like what are you doing to get better right now?
Yeah. I mean, in addition to all of my rehab and that, like, I mean, I've put on upper body. I've put on some good lean muscle pounds. So like I'm going to come out of this stronger upper body, more athletic because of the details I'm putting into my PT. But the two skill-wise things are better touch from around the hoop and keeping improving my touch and handling this rock better. And so, I mean, I'm 4 times a week, give or take, I've been on the road a lot lately, but I'm in the gym and working on my handles and working on my touch. You know, I'm not able to go play a 5-on-5 game or whatever, or even get in a real coming off screen workout and all that kind of stuff. But yet I can control my dribbling and how much I'm handling the rock and working to improve that, and how much I'm improving my touch around the basket end from mid-range area.
I mean, is that part of the kind of the vision for your development long term? I mean, you can do a lot of the role player things, attacking closeouts, but are you thinking more about like, well, let's say when I'm, you know, 4 years into my career, being able to run more pick and roll, right? Like that type of thing at a higher volume than perhaps you will on your first contract in the league.
Yeah. I mean, the game and career is going to develop, but I just want to be able to have the best foundation I can to be able to be effective in what the things that I know I do well and have a good base for if I need to come off of a ball screen, be able to do that at an extremely high clip and high efficiency rate. And
have teams questioned you much about, you know, your age? You're 24 now, you'll turn 25 later this year.
I've only ever heard that from outside people,
never from teams.
Not from teams. Teams love it. I've played in 180 college games. I've been in crazy situations. I've had to win games. I've lost games at the buzzer. I've had to learn from those things. And yeah, I've only ever heard that from outside media stuff. And so for me, I've been around. So it's like, I just tune that out and I just put my head down and do my thing. And so, yeah, I mean, fortunately, the teams that, like, I've been very positive about it, actually, where it's an advantage versus a disadvantage. And it's true, I'm not 18, but yet I don't need to be developed like an 18-year-old needs to be developed.
I mean, it is funny you say that, because I think, like, sometimes you talk to people around the league, a lot of them say, well, actually, having a guy who can come in right away and play on a rookie-scale contract is a big advantage from a team building standpoint.
I'd rather be 18 and be able to do what I do now, but
yeah,
it took me a little bit longer to get here. But
you played with an 18-year-old last year, AJ DiBonsa, who very well might be the number one pick.
Yeah.
Well, what's your best story about AJ DiBonsa?
I mean, I'll just say I can't remember who it was against. I think it was early on in the season, one of his putback dunks that was like just insane, man. A lot of respect for him, and I'm excited to see where he goes and how he continues to develop, and he's about the right things. And I'm an AJ fan, and I'm excited to see how he keeps growing in this game.
I got some random questions for you, Richie. What's your biggest motivator?
My family. Yeah.
What's your biggest pet peeve?
On the floor, pet peeve is, it all kind of works together, but it's like when people are posting their workouts or are kind of more focused on like showing that they're working instead of actually being about working, or like a lost post. Like I maybe that's just, other people got their own way of doing stuff, but that for me it's not how I do it. Yeah.
What's some music you like that might surprise some people?
It'd be surprising, but I love Bad Bunny. That's my favorite artist.
Okay. Bad Bunny. So you must have loved the Super Bowl halftime show, then, right?
Yeah. I mean, I love the music. Love the music.
I don't know much Bad Bunny. There's like one song I have on my, like, I have a night driving playlist. I'm sure there's probably a lot of Bad Bunny that works on a night driving playlist. I'm just trying to find the name of it so you could tell me if it's any good or not. Dakita, something like that. Dakiti.
Oh, Dakiti? Yeah, I do know what you're talking about, with the
semi truck. Yeah, Dakiti. Yeah. That's really good.
You're in the right spot.
Yeah, that's a great song. What's your weirdest habit?
Weirdest habit. We're gonna get reaching a whole nother level, but every time I walk into the Marriott Center Annex, I always touch stuffed cougars. Just like decoration. I always touch it, and I don't know why. I've never really shared that, but yeah, I would say that's the thing that came to my head.
Something tactically about it.
Yeah, I'm not suspicious. Just a little suspicious.
So you're gonna have to bring one of those to the NBA team in the draft soon.
Yeah. Just cut off the ear or something. Yeah. I don't know.
What do you do besides basketball? What are your interests?
Yeah, I mean, the basketball takes up a whole lot of time. I'd say recently we bought a house a couple of years ago and we were fixing it up, and so that was I actually loved learning how to fix stuff up. We did some remodeling and put in the backyard and stuff, and I mean, that's been a fun random thing, but it's helped me take my mind off of basketball too.
It's pretty cool. I mean you're married. How'd you meet her? Did you meet her at BYU in college?
Yeah. So she played on the women's team.
So, oh, that's awesome.
It worked out. I would need to work out, and it's been great. She's been my right by my side through all of the ups and downs of coaching changes, and now this is the biggest thing, right, of rehabbing ACL and stuff. And so we're ready to go wherever we go and tackle this thing together.
Does it matter to you to be a first round pick, or just about fit?
You know, I think before my injury, I think it would have mattered more. But now, look, I'm trying to go to the right team and get in the right situation. I don't actually care where or like what number I get drafted. You know, I think, again, so much of that is on the outside exterior stuff. But for me, I'm trying to find a good contract and a great team that values the things that I value, and where there's an opportunity. So if that's 25, 27, 29, or 35, or wherever I go, I don't even know. Like I'm fortunately, like, I feel satisfied where, like, I'm just ready to go and go attack this thing wherever I'm at.
Last question for you, Richie. What do you love most about basketball?
I would say I love just what it's given me. I mean, I've dedicated so much of my life to this game, and it's not only brought me my wife, but it's taken me around the world and connected me with so many people that have helped me along my journey. Like, I'm just telling you, like, I love that I get to dedicate so much of my life to this game, and something that I get to work at and do imperfectly, but try to just give my soul to this thing. And I mean, yeah, I love it, and I love that I get to keep playing this thing.
Richie, I can't wait to see you back at the court, man. You've been one of my favorite players to watch and see grow at the college level, and can't wait to see how the story unfolds moving forward in the NBA. I'm rooting for you, man. Yeah. And thanks for joining the show.
That. Yeah, man. Thank you.
Big thank you to Derek Parker and Richie Saunders for joining me on today's episode. We're going to be back again on Tuesday. We got another draft episode tomorrow. We'll also talk about everything else going on around the NBA, and then another episode on Thursday as well. And who knows? There could be an emergency podcast with Giannis Antetokounmpo on the block, potentially traded this week. So keep your eyes out for that. Thank you so much to Emmy and the team for producing today's episode. Talk to you soon, everybody.